My name is Mark Jansen. I'm with the International Security Program here at CSIS. Today is the 6th of February, 2008, and I'm interviewing Dr. John Foster, who is the chairman of the board at GKN Aerospace, and he is the former director of at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. Dr. Foster, pleasure to have you here. By way of introduction, can you please briefly describe your career to date, highlighting your role where you had a responsibility in the Mutual Defense Agreement, and how you actively collaborated at that time, and then what your role has been in the defense establishment and scientific community since that time?
Okay, Mark. I was born in the U.S., but I grew up in Montreal, Canada. And during World War II, my father and the family moved to Boston, where my dad worked at MIT on radar. And since I was there, I became a technician at Harvard University's Radio Research Laboratory. After developing or participating in the development of a microwave receiver, I was assigned to the 15th Air Force as an advisor on radar and radar countermeasures. And after the victory in Europe, I returned to the laboratory, and then the two atom bombs put an end to the Pacific operations, and so I returned to Montreal to finish my undergraduate work at McGill. Finishing that, I went to UC Berkeley for the graduate work. And finishing that, I left to go with Herb York and the 20-odd people to start the laboratory at Livermore. While there, I was assigned to develop small fission weapons and primaries, and Harold Brown was assigned the leadership of the thermonuclear program. I should just add a point about that, and that is that the instructions that I received at that time were that these fission weapons were not to be like Los Alamos. So they had to be different. And that turned out to be quite a challenge. Now, go ahead.
What did you know of the Los Alamos design at the time?
Very little. Nothing, in fact, other than what I'd read in the newspapers. So I spent every waking moment trying to think of ways to provide a device that would be superior to whatever Los Alamos came up with. And at the same time, however, we had complete cooperation from Los Alamos. So it was intense competition and full cooperation. Most of it, the cooperation coming from their side, since we barely had a laboratory, at least for the first few years. And of course, during that whole period, particularly in 1958 to 1965, I became involved in the UK-US operation and went to, as far as I know, most of the meetings during that time. In 1961, I became the director of the Livermore Laboratory, and in 1965, I left to follow Harold Brown as the director of Defense Research and Engineering in the Department of Defense. And of course, there, I also worked with the NATO armament directors, and in particular, arranged for a rather closely knit group of four of them, the UK, Germany, France, and the US. I left the Department of Defense in 1973 and went to industry, in particular to TRW. Retired from there in 1988, served on the board until 1994, and currently I'm a consultant to government and industry.
Excellent, thank you. If you can think back to your time as the early days as at Lawrence Livermore and the competition you had with Los Alamos and also cooperation, was that in any way affected or complicated by the collaboration with the UK in the wake of the 1958 agreement?
I don't think so. I seems to me not at all. I think the most interesting part was the part that I mentioned about the instructions to me, that they were ours were not to be like Los Alamos. And what was delightful about the interaction with the folks from Aldermaston was that their design was not like either of ours. And so I think that's perhaps the essential ingredient of being able to work constructively together as well as competitively to the advantage of both countries.
So are you saying that the UK had a different approach than Los Alamos with regards to development of atomic weapons? Can you tell me a little bit more about how they thought differently about atomic weapons and how their resources and their weapon designs impacted your work, obviously without divulging classified information?
We used to say that the UK did not have the resources that were made available in the United States, and therefore they had to think more. And that's what made the difference. They had to think of clever ways to get the job done more efficiently and every bit as effectively. So they came up with designs which were different from ours, both in the fission side and the thermonuclear side.
How were the scientists at Lawrence Livermore responding to the UK's insight? How receptive were they to it? And how did they feel when they got the opportunity to work together periodically?
Well, I can recall having heard about the UK idea for a fission weapon, asking the folks at Livermore to imagine how we could improve on that. And so we actually produced designs of the type that along the concept of the United Kingdom designs, and at the same time hopefully made some improvements with regard to effectiveness and production feasibility and so on. And we tested it successfully in nuclear tests underground.
Changing gears just a bit from the scientific development to the political implications of the agreement. This was seen by many as both a policy decision as well as a scientific decision to engage the UK in atomic weapons development. Can you tell me what the impact of the political aspect of the agreement was on you and your position at Lawrence Livermore, and whether created special challenges for you?
Well, first of all, Mark, I had no role that I recall in the formulation of the mutual defense agreement. I was aware at that time that there was growing concern over the consequences of nuclear weapons tests. In particular, we had conducted some multi-megaton tests in the Pacific, and on one occasion had fallout rained on a fisherman in the boat. And at the Nevada test site, there were one or two instances when I recall there was a fallout that was carried off-site and contaminated areas outside of the test site. So there was this growing concern over these long-lived radiation species that were being spread around the world. And so President Eisenhower sought to obtain a nuclear test moratorium. And at that time, as I recall, Prime Minister McMillan was reluctant to have that occur because of their position and with regard to the development of their programs. My understanding is that Eisenhower and McMillan reached an agreement on a joint collaboration for mutual benefit and to also support a nuclear test moratorium. And so then in the following year, 1959, Eisenhower and Khrushchev reached agreement on what we referred to as a gentleman's test moratorium. Eisenhower also asked the laboratories and the AEC to be ready to resume nuclear testing. Now, the interesting thing to me is that about a year later, we received a message from the chairman of the AEC, Glenn Seaborg, to the effect that we should stop the preparations that were underway in the Nevada test station, the test site, because the Soviets might come to the conclusion that we were preparing to test, and therefore it might provoke them to resume. The following year, Khrushchev announced that for their national security reasons, they were going to resume nuclear tests. And I remember calling Harold Brown when I heard this news and asked Harold, hey, what did he think about that announcement? And Harold said, oh, they're not going to do any such thing. This is the wrong time for that. Within a few days, the Soviets did resume a very large atmospheric test series. And the U.S. in the next month started to perform nuclear tests at the Nevada test site. And then we attempted to get ready to test in the Pacific. But again, there was this concern about fallout if we were to go to the Inuvituq test facility. And fortunately, the U.S. and the U.K. were able to reach agreement on the use of Christmas Island as a test site for those operations. And in fact, it was at that test series that the U.S. successfully tested the Polaris system. A missile was fired from an underwater, submerged submarine, and it went downrange, and the nuclear explosive functioned properly at the other end.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how the scientific collaboration between the U.S. and the U.K. was animated by Soviet testing, and without regards to the political strains on fallout, what the impact of that was on the level of the scientists and as far as motivating them in their work and in their collaboration?
Well, there are two aspects that stick in my mind. One was the Soviets boasting of a 100-megaton weapon and testing it at about 60 megatons yield. And also their experiments with nuclear explosions at very high altitude that resulted in a totally new set of phenomena that were observed by them. And we came to the conclusion that we needed to also look at that. It was clear, of course, that the Soviets had prepared for several years for that test series. And so that was a big shock to us. But it's also clear that the Soviets were on a different course. Their view about what was important was different from what the U.S. thought was important. We did not feel that very high yield nuclear weapons were the direction where we should go. But as I indicated, the Soviets took great pride in having that capability.
You mentioned how the U.S. Came to view nuclear weapons in a different way than the Soviets were. Do you feel as though that is in any way attributable to the experiences gained and learning to understand the weapons through interactions with the United Kingdom under the MDA?
Not ready for that.
Okay.
I don't recall the UK-US interaction having a major bearing on our views about the Soviets. What I do remember is that a 100-megaton warhead could wipe out the British Isles. And so, while it was abhorrent to us, it must have been at least as abhorrent to the UK folks. But it was just a different view. I remember the major efforts made by the Soviet Union in the early stages to be able to defend and survive against nuclear attacks. In the U.S., we tried the same thing, but we did not practice it and implement it to the extent that the Soviets did.
A little bit more of a personal question. As the director of the laboratory, what was your involvement in the joint working groups and coordinating them? Did this agreement put special? Did it entail special burdens on you in terms of organizing scientists and organizing collaboration with overseas counterparts?
I didn't see it as a burden at any stage. either from the time it started, the first stock take, or when I left the laboratory. I didn't see it as a burden. It seemed to me it was an opportunity, a challenge, to exchange views and developments, and to have both sides gain. No, definitely, it wasn't a chore.
Can you share a little bit more information about your personal contacts with within the scientific community in the U.S. and the U.K., people in particular that you worked with, and how you approached your relationship and how you viewed it?
Well, of course, I visited Los Alamos perhaps every month or two. And there I met with the folks who were in the high explosive facilities, the folks in the theoretical division, and so on. And in each of these exchanges, I would explain to them what it was I was proposing to do. And I would ask them, well, have you tried this? You know, does it work? And usually the answer was, well, we've thought about that, but we haven't tried it. Well, why haven't you tried it? Look, we're too busy taking care of all of the demands from the Army, Navy, Air Force. Everybody wants something. And we're doing the best we can to develop and at the same time put things into stockpile. So the question for us was then, do they think we should go ahead? Would they support our pursuing this thing? And frequently, most frequently, the answer was yes. So we gained both from their past experience where they had thought of things, didn't get a chance to do it. You have to make choices. We had an opportunity to think about it and pursue it. That was it. That was a great period when Livermore wasn't committed to supply a number of weapons to the stockpile, but just to think and explore and test. That was great. Now, when we went to a stock take, or even in between stock take periods, we had an opportunity to interact with the folks at Aldermaston. And I must say, I remember the very first meeting where Sir William Penny represented the UK side, and I remember Levin and Newley and John Corner. I remember him very well, Macklin and others. And we had plenty of time to talk about our different views. It's interesting in retrospect, at least for me, to realize that, by and large, the Los Alamos folks stayed on the course they were on for a long time. And the UK stayed on the course they were on for a long time. And the Livermore folks stayed on the course they selected for a long time. But there were improvements in all three as a result of knowledge of the progress that had been made by the other laboratories in their pursuit of their design.
Moving forward to your time in the Department of Defense, were you able, in your role there, did the collaboration on nuclear weapons with the UK have any bearing on your work within the Department of Defense?
That was not a dominant factor. I can remember becoming involved in the Polaris and Trident agreements, where I remember at one point working with Admiral Levering Smith on the U.S. side, I was concerned that members of Parliament had raised the assertion that the U.S. and U.K. folks were too close together in the facilities in the U.S., and that there was danger of not only of having U.K. folks being exposed to Trident activities. So I spoke with Levering about that, and as far as I know, it never went beyond that assertion stage.
Getting back to the weapons development more specifically, were you afraid at any point that there might be a point of diminishing returns on the collaboration where the U.S., the U.K., and began to think a little too much alike in terms of the weapons development that kind of inhibited the creativity, whereby kind of the same collaboration that helped you advance so far may over time create a sort of scientific groupthink, if you will, that may slow your progress? Was that ever a concern?
Never. No, in fact, it seems to me that the pace was rapid in the U.S. in both laboratories, and including the Sandia Corporation, and it was rapid in the U.K., and so there was a never-ending list of challenges and exchanges, and it was always interesting. It was competitive, stimulating, good.
Not to fast forward too far, but you raise an interesting point about that has come to light recently about nuclear weapons development in the U.S., and whether or not the work on the reliable replacement warhead, as it's called, as a way to kind of invigorate the scientific community, and the political opposition to that maybe being an inhibitor to recruiting new generations of scientists with an enthusiasm for the work to create something new, as opposed to just stewarding existing stockpiles. Can you talk for just a minute about your feelings on that?
Well, first of all, I think we have to realize that without being able to test in the atmosphere, without being able to test underground, we cannot prove that our weapons are safe and reliable. We can't know that they're safe and reliable. Therefore, every scientist and engineer realizes that if you can't prove something, you're running some risks. So the challenge then, without being able to test, is to try and figure out what processes will give you the best chance of being able to maintain a safe and reliable weapon system. Now, in the U.S., the Department of Defense has made it clear that they would like to have in the stockpile for every major delivery system some diversification in the type of warhead. Now, in particular, for the Trident system, we need to have two different kinds of warheads, and the W-76 currently is the predominant warhead in that system. And we have a long history of finding what we call birth defects. And so the idea is to make sure that we set up processes to find these defects. These defects could come in when one refurbishes the warheads because they are now 20-odd years old and in need of refurbishment. So something has to be done. And that's one course. Another course is to design warheads which are not quite as highly tuned as the ones that have been put into stockpile during the 80s. Now that is something we can do, and we can do it with fair confidence. The important thing there, however, is again to make sure that you have vetted to the extent you can the design all the way through to the deployment and operational readiness alert tests of the stockpile. And now, to do that means that one has to use a very thorough process of red teaming. And I think we have a ways to go in that direction. We do, I think, a pretty good job of competing Los Alamos against Livermore in the designs. We do some of it with regard to Sandia's components. I think we should be able to do more. I'm not persuaded we do as good a job as we should at involving the production folks and the integration, surveillance, operational demos, and so on. I think we can do a better job there. So the big advantage that I see of this so-called RRW approach is first that it causes this whole community of folks to work together. So the theoretical folks are no longer sort of confined to the use of the computer. And the development folks are no longer focused just on improving this, that, and other engineering features, and so on and so on. Instead, there is this required linkage from the design to the science, engineering, laboratory tests, prototype production, production, integration, so on, into the fleet, operational testing, and so on.
Do you feel that the US-UK agreement has any bearing on this development at this time?
Yes, I think so. But let me just finish the last part that I was addressing. And that is that once you make these linkages and perform those operations, you not only have honed your skills, but you have demonstrated competence. I can recall the observation made by an AWRE director after the end of the 1962 moratorium, when he said, having looked back and reviewed what went on in the laboratory during those 3 years, he said, "Our confidence rose as our competence declined." So the importance of RRW, in my mind, independent of whether you put anything in like that in the stockpile, is that it will improve the competence by demonstrating the competence of everyone involved.
So the RRW then, you're saying, creates a sort of a cohesion within the nuclear weapons establishment, is that
yes, correct? That's correct. Okay.
Getting back to the MDA, have Have you seen the nature of the collaboration change in any specific way since its inception over the past 40, 50 years now?
I have not, because I have just not been involved. I mean, my only intimate involvement was during those periods from 1958 to 1965.
In your view, is it still a relevant agreement, even if you're not intimately involved in its the applications of it today?
Oh, certainly. Oh, yes. Very much so. We have a new set of conditions now. We have potential adversaries that are different. We have terrorists. All these things change the requirements of the nuclear deterrent. And so it's important that we maintain that activity and undertake new possibilities.
At the time the agreement was forged, it was viewed by some as being a quid pro quo kind of arrangements whereby the balance of the scientific advancements would go to the benefits of the scientific advancements, the balance of them would go to the UK, whereby the in return for support from the UK for US foreign policy in general. From what I hear from you, that doesn't seem to have been the way you viewed that. It wasn't so much a quid pro quo arrangement as it was a scientific endeavor. Have I captured your thoughts on that correctly, or was there some feelings as though this was the balance of the benefits were scientifically going to the UK and maybe some reluctance to continue in that way?
No, as I said earlier, I thought it arose out of the concern by Eisenhower to obtain a test moratorium, and at the same time, Prime Minister Macmillan was anxious to improve his nuclear capabilities before entering into such an arrangement. And therefore, they struck this agreement whereby they would benefit both countries on the nuclear aspects, and at the same time, they could both agree to go for a moratorium on nuclear testing. And then, the subsequent year, that was consummated by Eisenhower and Khrushchev.
From where you sat, did you see a large amount of enthusiasm amongst your scientists at Lawrence Livermore for collaborating with the UK? And can you recall any anecdotes or stories that would serve as a testament to their enthusiasm for collaborating with their counterparts overseas?
Well, as I indicated, when we heard about the UK approach to a Los Alamos type of fission or a primary design, we decided to pick it up and see if we could improve on it, and we did successfully test it. However, that did not stick in the as an approach for the Livermore Laboratory, nor did it stick as an approach for Los Alamos.
Sorry for the pause. Can you think of any in particular points of contention or policy challenges that you encountered either within or outside the scientific community when it came to collaborating with the UK? Was there any reluctance whatsoever amongst your scientists or from people that you were interacted with outside of your job that affected your thinking about whether or not we were how we should collaborate, what the limits of that collaboration should be, if any?
No, I don't recall that.
Moving ahead, there was some concern on the UK side about continuing nuclear weapons development in such a way that would perpetuate an arms race that would put the UK in a position where they were completely dependent upon the United States to deter a Soviet attack. Did you see any hesitance on their part, or did that concern manifest itself in any of your collaborations with the scientists or people in the political community?
No, not that I recall.
The transfer of scientific knowledge from one generation to the next is getting to be a challenge for the scientific community, according to some, and was wondering whether or not you feel as though the U.S.-UK collaboration in any way helps or assists in the in recruiting new scientists both within this country and overseas in bringing them to do nuclear weapons work and having them be excited about it?
Well, first of all, we can't know the future. And since we can't know the future, it seems to me that we should maintain a two-track approach. On the A track, it's important to reduce the total number of nuclear weapons worldwide. It's important to cultivate cooperative relationships with the potential adversaries, that's China, Russia, terrorists, and others. We should limit proliferation of not only nuclear weapons, but also the materials, the fissionable materials. We should prepare for the ratification of a comprehensive test ban treaty. We should have increased cooperation with France. And as I indicated earlier, I think we ought to cooperate on processes that will enhance and maintain the nuclear safety and reliability of these weapons. Now that's the A track. On the B track, I think we have to hedge it against the continued buildup of nuclear weapons by Russia and China. I think we have to enhance the confidence that we have in the reliability and safety of these weapons. And we have to demonstrate this competence in the people, all the way from the designers through to the folks who are responsible for maintaining and keeping the nuclear weapons that are deployed in good shape and ready. Now, that calls for the development of red teams. And I think it would be very useful for the US, UK, Russia, France, China, to discuss how they propose to maintain this. What are their processes to maintain it without testing? But, you know, I suspect that for the next decade or so, Russia and China will continue to improve their and increase the number of their deployed nuclear weapons. And so the West will need all the cooperation it can muster in order to limit those activities and avoid a nuclear arms race.
You feel that Russia will increase, and China as well, the number of deployed nuclear warheads. Begs an interesting question about the future of arms control. And, you know, we've seen the ABM fall by the wayside, and then Russia threatening to and then eventually withdrawing from the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. What do you feel is the future of arms control, and whether and what the impact it could have on the relationship between the U.S. And Russia and China and other countries around the world?
Well, as I indicated a few minutes ago, I consider it necessary to pursue the A-track and to make every effort. You see, it's a much more difficult and complicated task that we have because of the many different nations that are involved. Much more difficult than the way it was with the Soviet Union, with just one nation. So it's going to take a larger team than we had, but today we have a much smaller team.
What do you think it would take to build up that team and to get more people involved, both here and abroad?
Well, of course, you can't conduct that kind of activity effectively without having people who are trained and trusted. And that takes some time. And so I would hope that the U.S. and the U.K. and others will do everything they can to build up those teams and train those people, because it is not enough to just go to an ally and brief them on what the situation is. One ought to find out from the ally if we want them to be assured. Are they assured? If not, what would assure them? What kind of conditions do we collectively feel we should try to bring about? How can we do that? And so that's a much bigger effort, I think, than we have underway at the moment.
It would seem as though the MDA was a critical step and a critical time in that direction in terms of alleviating some anxiety for the UK. Would you agree? And what from your experiences would serve as evidence of that, if anything?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that talking about missile defense as one approach to limit the potential damage that a rogue nation could cause. However, at the same time, it can be considered a threat as seen by China or Russia. And so getting the balance right over the next 10 years or so is going to be a very tricky operation.
How do you feel the, this is a little bit off topic perhaps, but then how do you feel about the political direction of Russia right now and whether or not, and the challenges that may pose to the arms control kind of conundrum that we see today?
Well, I think President Bush at the outset, excuse me, made a major effort to try and gain some understanding with President Putin. Unfortunately, from Putin's point of view, they now see a Russia surrounded by former Warsaw Pact nations that are supportive of the United States and the Western Alliance. And so they feel encircled by superior conventional capabilities. And their only interim defense capability is nuclear weapons. And so they are emphasizing that aspect. So on the one hand, the United States and others are trying to reduce the number of weapons and so on and so on. And here Russia is trying to increase theirs, at least the development and the weapon systems and so on. So I see that as leading to a potential asymmetry that could be unstable.
Would you consider the collaboration with the UK as something that would have been possible with any other country at the time that the MDA was signed? And if so, why or why not?
You can't conclude that it was impossible. We tried it with the UK, and we had a good reason to do so, and we pulled it off. On the other hand, we are closer to the UK, have been for decades, than we are to any other nation.
Dr. Foster, a little while ago you mentioned the red teams. Can you tell me a little bit more about what they were and how they worked?
Well, my first exposure to a red team came with the very first device that we proposed for test. The Livermore Laboratory had a prior test that was a failure. And so when my term came, I was all set to go, and the director, Dr. York, said, well, look, we're going to have a pre-mortem of this design. Now, the ground rules of a pre-mortem were that this device that he's proposing to test in Nevada has been tested and it failed. And the task to the pre-mortem committee is to find out why it failed and to make recommendations on what to make sure, what to do in order to make sure that that does not happen. So I made the presentation to the committee on how this works and why there's no problem. And then I was reminded by the committee chairman that I didn't understand the ground rules. This device has failed. So I felt defenseless, and they went about their business. Now, in the end, they did not find an Achilles heel. But nevertheless, they recommended I add a little more plutonium. I did that, and it went a little bit high. So that's a red team. Now, recently, when the RRW designs were performed by Los Alamos and Livermore, the NNSA asked the Livermore laboratory to critique the Los Alamos design and the Los Alamos laboratory to critique the Livermore design. And those are red teams. And I think they did a very good job, even though neither design was really finished. So I think in the future, since we are running risks by not being able to test, it is important that we make every effort we can to scrutinize the designs from the design all the way through to their deployed configuration and handling, in order to give us the best chance of discovering whether or not there are any potential flaws there.
And this without testing?
And yes, you do this without testing, yes. The idea is to, in the process of doing it, you do two things. One, by going through that exercise, you develop not only skills, but competence. You demonstrate competence. And that's necessary.
Your point about demonstrating competence reminds me of a point you made earlier on about the competition between Los Alamos and Livermore. And I'm wondering if in any way the UK scientists were competitive, had that same competitive streak, and if so, how that came out or surfaced in your collaboration.
I think the UK was at a disadvantage because they did not have a sister laboratory to compete against. And I think it would be to the UK's advantage in the future if we were to undertake some form of, at least initially, some form of exchange of information, how we go about assuring that we have done our best to provide for a safe and reliable systems. Of course, there is also now a new set of conditions that we are exposed to with regard to terrorists and others. And so these laboratories will be involved in making sure that these designs are safe against a one-point initiation of the high explosive. To make sure that as they age, any particular flaws that creep in are avoided. Make sure that we have not only permissive action links that are appropriate, but also begin to consider what's called use control, see whether or not any improvements can be made along those lines. So there are differences in the requirements that are imposed now as compared to what we used to have in the past. And so there's room for value to come from a collaboration.
Well, thank you for that, and I think we will end on that note, being that we are out of time. Dr. Foster, thank you for being here, and thank you for being willing to talk with us about U.S.-UK collaboration.
Well, look, in closing, I want to thank you for this opportunity, but I would also like to add a point about the value of these cooperations that we have had. You see, my sense is that our democracies will not, and certainly not for long, support large standing forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, and so on, unless there is a threat to our nation. And therefore, it is of paramount importance that at this time we enhance and maintain a modern and capable intelligence operation to the extent that we possibly can. And the reason for that is that intelligence is the leading edge of our national security. And unless you have a good understanding of what the threats are to this nation, you cannot attract scientists and engineers and military folks to work on programs like national weapons programs and expect them to dedicate their career to that. Okay?
Point well taken. Again, thank you.